Hello and welcome to this NDTV special. It is said that this moment in time is an inflection point for the gender debate in India. At one level, if you look at the headlines on the television channels and in the newspapers, it would seem that things are getting worse. Because every day, there is some story of sexual violence, some complaint of sexual violence that actually occupies the public debate. Whether there are allegations of sexual harassment against retired Supreme Court judges, famous journalists, or of course, the gang rape in Delhi that first created a mass protest on the streets. Is gender finally at the heart of the political debate instead of on the margins of the social debate as it has been for so many years? And what does the word feminism mean to women in the 21st century? Well, I can share with our viewers that for so many of us, we were shaped and formed in our growing up years by Gloria Steinem. She's been described as being to the women's movement was Martin Luther was to the civil rights movement. She is indisputably one of our most important voices in this century on the issue of gender. And on this program today, we are very privileged to have her with us. So let's have a big round of applause. I know so many people here have been following her writings over the years. We're also very privileged to have with us Professor Amartya Sen. He is, of course, not just a Nobel laureate, but he is a man of great compassion. And he is very outspoken, exactly like Gloria, on issues of gender development and equality. We're also joined by Ruchira Gupta. She is a very, very important voice in the sex trafficking movement, something that we don't actually pay enough attention to, and something that remains a very polarized debate. When it comes to prostitution, opinions are divided. Is legalizing the best way? Is decriminalizing? And finally, we have in the studio Urvashi Bhutalia, again, one of our most important and prominent feminist voices. And Urvashi, of course, has been associated for Kali for Women, does great sterling work when it comes to the publishing area, and is also an outspoken commentator. And from Mumbai, joining us is Nandita Das. She's, of course, not just somebody we know from our cinema screens, but we also know her for, again, her outspoken activism on issues that matter to us all. And, of course, we've got a young audience here raring to go with their questions. But, Gloria, I'd like to start with you. Do you believe that the word feminism still has meaning? How did it get to a point when it became such a disputed word? Why is it that every time you ask somebody, are you a feminist, people will normally say, yes, but?
Well, speaking for my own experience in my own country, it is more popular than it used to be.
You think?
Yes, no, definitely. We all were crazy people in the beginning, you know, as far as it has. If you look at the public opinion polls, for instance, you see that it has steadily increased in its approval. Part of the problem with people who disapprove is that they don't know what it means. Mm. And if they go to the dictionary and see it just means the full social, economic, political equality of males and females, they'll say yes. I mean, this is not a public relations movement. This is a revolution. And it means huge, huge changes in every part of life. I should also say that not everybody has to use the same word. You know, people say womanist or Mujerista for Spanish-speaking women, or girls with three R's, which I kind of love, you know.
You're saying the nomenclature is irrelevant.
It's not irrelevant, no, because it's important to identify our belief in equality, and we need, how we do it is up to us, but since we have a system based economically and socially and culturally on a lot of inequality and violence, it is important, I think, to state our beliefs, if only to get support from other people who feel the same.
Okay. Professor Amartya Sen, you have done a fascinating essay in the aftermath of the gang rape that took place in Delhi and really brought gender to the mainstream of our public debate. And one of the things that you statistically map is how within India, there is actually a difference if you look at the north and the west of the country and the south and the east when it comes to sex ratios, when it comes to female infanticide. You also recorded very interestingly that if you compare rape statistics in India and compare them to rape statistics in the United States or the United Kingdom or even Sweden, the frequency of rape, even if you just assume that rapes are being underreported, is not as high in India as it is in other countries. What does this tell us about what's going on with India when it comes to gender?
Well, I think that's the way to deal with the problem. Because I think the numbers are quite staggering, actually, that rate of rape in India, which is per 100,000, is less than 2%, as reported, compared with 27 in USA, 29 in UK, and so on. Of course, I think there are two issues there. One is, this is, of course, clearly underreporting.
Yes.
But secondly, even if it is underreported by, say, 1 in 10, even then the number, instead of being 1.8, will become 18, which is still lower than the UK and US. I don't think the problem is so much the frequency of rape. Mm. It's the fact that you can get away with it, especially when it's done to the poorer group. You know, we all salute what happened in the movement following the 16th of
December
brutality, but the fact that it was a college woman made a difference. Now, Dalit women have been raped day in and day out without that getting any kind of notice, and I think one of the reasons why the sexual trafficking issue in which Russia is so involved, and rightly, involvement comes from the necessity that it's very difficult to put it in the consciousness of the Indian middle classes that there is a terrible thing happening there. Because mainly they're the families from which sex trafficking girls are picked up happen to be at the bottom layer of the society.
Yeah.
So it's the mixture of class.
I want to ask Nandita a question here, and that is that growing up, Nandita, and you know, many of us borrowed from the Western construct of feminism. That is where women of a certain socioeconomic strata, and we might be very minuscule numerically, but we borrowed our ideas from the West. As we grew up and we were exposed to the Indian debate, we found many of our assumptions challenged. Many women spoke about choice. They didn't want us foisting our ideas of feminism on them. Now, when I look at the United States of America, and I'm going to ask Gloria about this, certain issues that we take for granted here in India, abortion, as distinct, by the way, from female infanticide, the right to abortion, women in high political office, we take this for granted. We had Indira Gandhi, we have Sushma Swaraj, we have Sonia Gandhi. America's still debating Hillary Clinton, is she going to make it or not? How do you explain this debate, these dichotomies?
Well, I think one of the better things of globalization, and it has many other problems, is that we are able to hear each other, we are able to borrow ideas from each other much more today. And it, as the world gets smaller, you also have the opportunity to look within and find your own idioms, your own nomenclature, your own vocabulary. At the time when we were growing up, there wasn't really a word that was here, that existed. So I guess it resonated, the idea resonated with some of the women writers and, you know, people like Gloria Steinem, whom we have all grown up admiring and, you know, deriving inspiration from. That's why I think we took it, and there was still less of us talking about it. I think today feminism, unlike what Gloria said, that it's, you know, it's probably grown, here people still sort of scorn at you that, you know, oh, you're a feminist. It's seen as a bad word. But today even being secular is seen as a bad word, which is the irony of things. So, but I think in our country, which is so varied and diverse, it means different things to different people. And I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Gloria Steinem, before I go to Urvashi and Ruchira, why is it so complicated for women to occupy the highest political office in the United States of America? Hillary Clinton may change that, she may, but it's very strange to watch this country that gave us people like yourselves, that gave us petty freedom, that gives us otherwise enshrined principles of equality, to say, oh, somehow the woman being the president of the United States of America would be radical.
Mm. I couldn't agree with you more.
Where
is
the resistance?
I keep saying this at home all the time.
Where is the resistance?
Part of the reason is that wherever there is more power, there is more competition for power. So because the United States, I would say wrongly and not forever, but anyway, regards itself as a world power, then the competition for the top spot is greater. Also, probably the familial influence is less important in the States. So, if Indira Gandhi had a brother, would she have been prime minister? No, I think probably her brother would have been, right? I can't guess, but I think so. So for for us,
Professor said, of course, the question then would be that Rahul Gandhi does have a sister. So is there a gender? Is there a gender angle somewhere there?
The plot thins, right? So.
India Barkha.
Yeah.
It's not just India. I mean, whether you see Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, they've all had women sort of leaders in their state. Right?
But I think the point Gloria is raising is that if they had brothers, though of course in Benazir's case she did have, she did have a brother. The brother was killed. But it's an interesting question.
It's sort of hard to get elected when, right?
Okay. Yeah.
But I think in a deep sense, I'm about to go far out here, so brace yourself. Anyway, I think. In a deep sense for us, until children are raised as much by men as by women, we will continue to associate female authority with childhood. Men and women associate it with childhood. That it's somehow emotional or irrational or not appropriate to public life. And I think women feel this too. Men may feel it more because the last time they saw a woman in authority, they were 8. You know, so they feel... unmanned in some sense by seeing a powerful woman. I do think it's changing enormously.
But it's an important point, Urvashi, that the patriarchy inside the home, and so much of it is unquestioned. It's being questioned today. But even the current debate around should Priyanka Gandhi join politics, a lot of commentators will say, well, she has chosen to focus on her children right now. This is not the critique that you would have ever of a male politician.
No, you wouldn't, no. But I think, Barkha, the question that you're asking about why is it that in the United States it's so difficult to accept what here seems to be widely accepted and historically true, if you look at the history of the United States and the history of India, many more women stand out in the history of India, in South Asia, than do in the United States.
Yes.
There is a way in which women have learnt about power. So... about politics, we never say, have we borrowed from the West? But about feminism, we always do. And actually, just as politics within South Asia is homegrown, so also feminism in South Asia is, to my mind, totally homegrown. People of my generation, I would say the first generation of feminists in the 70s, what did we draw on? I mean, Gloria was a great icon. Ms. Magazine, that she edited for a long time, was terribly important to us. But really, our heroes were drawn from our mothers, the women who took part in the freedom movement. So I don't really think that question should be asked. I think it's a loaded question.
No, the question is asked because I think, as Nandita said, so many feminists are regarded as belonging to the elite. It is considered an elitist word in India.
That doesn't matter. See, Gloria said the nomenclature was important. I think it's important. And it is considered an elitist word. And I don't think we should worry too much about that because, okay, you call yourself a feminist if you want to, and if you don't want to, it doesn't matter. What's important is what you do and how you live.
I just want to say that when you were first speaking and describing feminism, I felt I should raise my hand and say that by accident, kind of, I lived here for 2 years when I was in my 20s, and I was inspired here by Kamala Devi Chattopadhyay, and I have continued to feel inspired and informed by the women's movement here. For instance, Ila Bhatt and Sewa has taught us economic development.
And also equality is, for example, Gloria spoke about equality. It's a very difficult concept here for women because equality with whom? A Dalit woman being equal to a Dalit man, you still inhabit a huge ladder of inequality. Or a Dalit woman being equal to an upper class man, you know.
So what are the benchmarks here? What are you comparing?
Yeah, in a sense, you have to start thinking within the realities of
Professor Mathisen, Urvashi makes a very important point that there will be class, there will be cultural differences, there will be so many issues. There will just be personal environments, growing up under the influence of different parenting. So when it comes to those differences in the gender debate, how important is consensus? Because people keep saying it's about choice.
There are many dimensions to the disadvantage that women have, and some of them are more clear in the Indian context than in the American, and some other context in rising to political top leadership, as Nandita was mentioning. It may be just the other way around. The fact, if you're an upper class woman, the question of sharing of family load might not appear. You might have servant, etc. If you look at them, these are all upper class women, and they're privileged in some ways. we talk. So I think the issue of class and gender being linked, which I think obviously was there emphasizing, is totally central to it. You know, I will come back to, if I may, on the issue about whether feminism means something. I hope I don't surprise people by saying I was one of the founders and still remain an editorial board member of Feminist Economics. The fact that I'm not a woman didn't interfere with that, though it caused confusion sometimes.
Confusion to whom? To you or to the other people?
To people who write to me saying, "Dear Ms. Sen, since my name ends with A," and my favorite letter began saying, "Dear Ms. Sen, they will never understand us." And so I think, but on the other hand, I think the understanding on which the Feminist Economics as a journal began was that it's not just a women's issue. It is concerned with women.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's concerned with women's agency. But it is an issue of men as well as women.
Okay, let me get Ruchira in, because you spoke about, Professor Sen spoke about agency for women. And, and one of the things that we are still debating is how much of an agency does a woman have when it comes to reproductive rights, when it comes to sexual autonomy. Does she even have agency over her own body? Now, this takes us to the heart of the sexuality debate. Ruchira, as you work with victims of sex trafficking, you will also hear counter-arguments, and we hear them more and more in India today, saying it's a woman's right if she wants to barter her body for something else. Criminalizing prostitution has not helped women. It's only made it tougher for them. You have consistently, and I think so has Gloria, argued against this simplistic construct. Why? Because if it's about choice, and I'm being a bit of a devil's advocate here, but if it is about choice, what would you say to the number of sex workers who may come and say, actually, I need this to be a decriminalized space because I do not need to be harassed by the police. I'm already harassed by the pimps. I'm sometimes harassed by my clients. I don't now need to be harassed by security.
I would agree with them because we work with them in Sonaghachi and Kamtipura and in Khidirpur. And what I see actually is that, yes, they are brutalized by the police.
Yes.
But they're also brutalized by the pimps and the clients and the brothel managers. So what I argue for and what they argue for is what I argue for, is that they want their criminalization to be decriminalized. They don't want to be arrested for soliciting in a public place by the police, but they do want those who exploit them to be criminalized and to be recognized as people who are exploiting them. So the pimps, the recruiters, the transporters, the brothel managers, the brothel keepers.
What about the clients?
The entire
what about
sex
the
industry.
Users?
Even about the clients, they have different responses to different clients. So they say if it's a young boy who's coming to us for the first time, he should get a lesser punishment. He should be educated because he may not know what he's doing.
But I'm a little confused because if you start arresting the men who go to these women, and wouldn't that not shut down their trade?
Yes, of course it would. It would be a deterrent to their trade, and it has been tried in Norway and Sweden, where those who buy sex have been criminalized, and the selling of sex has been decriminalized. So the women and girls are not punished, but it's the men who buy them who are punished. And what?
And you believe that's how it should be?
It has helped the women because it has forced the governments then to recognize that women need investment to have other choices, other jobs other than prostitution. So this can help states actually excuse themselves from investing in what I call the last girl. And the last girl is that person who is in a village, who is low caste, who's poor, who's female. And the intersection of her inequalities actually increases her lack of choices. And we see prostitution as absence of choices, and we want the government to invest in that girl. But if they decide that this is her choice, they blind themselves to what they should be doing.
Gloria, you have said in many of your presentations and your speeches that prostitution is not an inevitability. But there are many others in the women's movement who are actually saying that this is imposing a kind of pressure on the women who may even have been coerced initially, but actually now don't know any other life. They would like autonomy within that space.
Well, I think the basic problem is that, you know, whenever there are only two choices, it's wrong. You know?
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes, yeah.
Because there is a third choice.
Which is what?
Which is Ruchira is saying, which is to decriminalize the women, have choices and support for the women, not to criminalize the men, but to penalize and educate the men. What we do know is that wherever there is more equality between women and men, there is less prostitution. You know, we know that it's not a good job, and we know that most women who are in it would like to have alternatives. And we know that those two extremes, you know, legalization in Germany and the Netherlands and so on, brought sex tourism big time, and then there were too few people in those prosperous countries who wanted to be a prostitute, so it increased trafficking from Africa, from East Europe, and so on. We can see what the consequences are. It's very, very complicated.
No, it is complicated.
But I would like to say one thing, because I think that what we're not, what we're assuming
is
that we, how shall I say this? It is, controlling women is about controlling reproduction. That is as important as production, and it's just so much part of the air we breathe that, that we don't think about it. If we didn't have wombs, we'd be fine. You know, I mean, this is about controlling reproduction, and especially in the presence of other biases, especially when there is caste, when there is poverty, when there is race, because it, to continue a caste system or a racial bias, you have to control the bodies of women. You have to make sure.
And you, do you see prostitution as an expression of that control?
Yes, I mean, if to the superior women are supposed to be pure and remain on a pedestal, right? The inferior women are open to sexual abuse from everyone.
Nandita, I want to ask you, especially wearing your hat as someone who's from the film industry, where is that balance between somebody not foisting a puritanical construct of your own sexuality on you, but on the other extreme, does the camera traveling in a sort of salacious way over a bare-bodied navel signify empowerment? I don't know. I've never figured out the answer to this. Have we replaced one male gaze with another male gaze?
No, you're absolutely right. And just like you, I also don't know, because I'm not really in the industry. I'm as much a viewer as you are. And I've often wondered that what is this thing about choice? Because we all, of course, uphold this freedom of choice. And a lot of film actors have also talked about it. I remember in one of your programs, in fact, on NDTV, Priyanka Chopra had a big debate with Shabana Azmi about this. And she said, this is, you know, it's a matter of choice, what I choose to wear, how the camera chooses to go over me, it's with my approval. And someone else may say that this is male gaze. I mean, look at Dirty Pictures. I know it's one of the most sort of celebrated films. It's, some people call it a feminist film, but, you know, I do feel a little uncomfortable seeing a film which is about a woman who has, through, you know, because of many problems that she has to do certain kind of roles, she's going through struggles, she commits suicide at the end. And despite that, it's not a film about a tragedy of a woman. The camera, you know, looks at her in the same gaze about which that she's struggling. So, I mean, there are these contradictions, and like you, I mean, it does make me uncomfortable. So, I don't know, I'm probably leaning towards the other side, but I'm not so sure what the answer is.
No, I think we're all going through that. And Urvashi, this debate around decriminalizing or not prostitution.
Wait, it's not just two choices.
I was going to elaborate. Uchira and Gloria are saying that there is another way
there
of doing
a third way.
Is to protect the women, but not the men who actually exploit them, and that includes clients, penalize them, if not make treat them as criminals. Do you believe that that is the best or the most progressive or the most equitable way, given the circumstances that we're dealing with?
Actually, I don't think that I'm qualified to answer that question in any sort of thought out way, because this is not a field I've worked on. I do know that within the feminist movement, there is a debate on, you know, these are the two ends of the spectrum. Gloria and Ruchira saying there's a third way, but I think there are many, many things in between. And you get the stories of the sex worker who says, well, it's my choice, you know, like Nalini Jamila, I'm doing it, and I enjoy it, this is my life. And you get stories of the exploited sex workers. They've obviously got, it's a very complex question, and to me, what it sheds light on is a question that you raised earlier, which has been a very troubling question for the women's movement, and that is the question of women's agency and choice. You know, there was a time when we in the feminist movement used to think that agency, that is a woman's right to choose, is only ever positive. And then we saw the Hindutva, the rise of Hindutva, and we saw the rise of the militant Hindu woman, who said, this empowers me, this strengthens me, and here she was acting against other women. And for feminists in India, that was a big shock, and that was a big learning experience to say, is this the kind of agency we were talking about?
You know, Ruchi, so you wanted to come in there and ask
yes,
something questions.
Just, yes. You know, the whole notion of agency and choice, I've seen it at play inside the red light areas. In
have you ever met a sex worker where you have been convinced that this is a choice and a free choice?
I've never met a prostituted woman who says that it is a complete free choice because she's poor, she's low caste. Whoever I've met has been that person. And in that context, she does find some agency after she's prostituted because she's in a brothel and she needs to survive. So she does find the agency to be able to go out and buy some groceries, try to bring her daughter to our school which we run or something like that. But even then she knows that that agency is also shrinking as she grows older.
I understand what you're saying, and yet Professor said in the United States, just to take an example, there are these stories that you read in the media of strip clubs, for example, where you'll have an architect who is doing this on the side. It's almost like waiting tables, or that is what she will say. And she will say, this is my choice.
Yes, I have met women who finance their master's degree by being... Yes, and she was profoundly sexually abused as a child, and she really came to believe she had only a sexual value. So, we were at a university lecture the other day, and a woman stood up in the audience and said, if prostitution were great, men would be doing it. And everybody applauded and yelled and screamed. Body invasion is a different level of trauma.
Professor, this very complex question of agency. But and that when women... Sorry, Nandini, you want to come in quickly and then I'll take it to Professor Sid?
No, I just want to say... Yeah, just a quick thought. Shohini Ghosh's film, Tales of the Night Fairies.
Yes.
You know, which is shot in Shonagachi, which is one of the most biggest organization that work with sex trafficking. And many of the women, in fact, talked about the fact that it's not about enjoyment, but this is their right. The fact that they want to have right over health issues, about, you know, facilities of health, about for their children. So what about rights? What about their rights if you criminalize it or if you illegalize it? What happens to the right-based issues of these sex traffickers?
I mean, I think Rochira wants to answer that.
They should have rights to be able to send their children to school. They should have rights to access public health. And this should be the rights available to all women in any situation. And when we talk about criminalizing, that's why we don't want the women to be criminalized in any way at all. We want the pimps and the johns and the sex industry to be criminalized.
Or illegalize it.
We don't even want... the law is that anyone can sell her body for sex if she wants to, but the sex industry should be criminalized, and that's what we are asking.
Okay,
it's like treating commercial rape as the same way as rape.
And are you saying that prostitution is commercial rape?
Yes, it is.
Professor Sen, is prostitution commercial rape?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. I just heard the word first time now, and it might well be. But, you know, I think I do have a problem with the way that the debate is going. We have some absolutely terrible cases of exploitation of women. The issue of choice doesn't arise.
Yes.
They're sexually trafficked, tiny kids, they go away. And there are also issues of rape. Some of it get attention, others don't. So given all that, I'm, after all, intellectual, like all of us here, quote-unquote. And I would like to know the answer to all these questions. On the other hand, there are an enormous number of things to be done immediately in India, of which nothing is happening. And I think just that I've always been against the best being the enemy of the good.
And the perfect not be.
And there's so many things to be done. And I would like, I don't want to stifle that discussion that should
but
go on
but
as to whether prostitution can be called.
But Professor Singh, come in with a thought on that and then I'll start taking questions. You have actually written about how Bangladesh, for example, has done better than India when it comes to certain empirical measures of what's happening to our women and our girls.
Yes, that's absolutely right. You see, in some ways, their independent movement, partly for issues that Urvashi pointed out, namely that here, the nationalist movement has always had women leaders look up to. And in some ways, when that, I mean, that was not when the country was partitioned in 47. There wasn't a dramatic issue there, because in Bangladesh, going to be East Pakistan, these were 10 years of riot and violence that we saw and on which I've written. But once that went and Bengali nationalism and separatism came in, there was looking back at the history and culture. Mm. A lot of the figure emerging were, of course, women. Mm. And so I think the entire dialogue changed in a kind of radical way, which it hasn't, there have been attempt to withdraw from that territory because of Jamaat and so on, but it hasn't really fully happened. So given that, I think we have to see how a cultural understanding of the role of women could make a very big difference. The fact that Bangladesh does better than India, it used to have 2 years less life expectancy 20 years ago. Mm. It has now 3 years more. Mm. The fact that its mortality rates for children are lower, the fact that the fertility rate is lower than in India. All this indicates a kind of involvement of women in every sphere of life.
Yeah.
From education, I mean, Bangladesh is the only country in the world where there are more girls than boys in school. There are major things to be learned which could make a transformation in the lives of people. I would like the complicated questions not to go away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would like
but
to
you,
think
you
about
to
whether prostitution is commercial rape.
Yeah.
But let's not delay things that can be done on which we
absolutely
agree right
so
now.
Okay, I've seen so many
agree.
Hands.
I so agree.
I've seen so many hands go up, so I'm just going to start taking questions. The young lady here in the front row.
I know for one, Gloria, that you've opposed pornography before and how you've distinguished it from pornography to erotica. But the woman today is more liberated than before in terms of her political freedom, freedom over money, and she's also more sexually liberated. So what are your views on feminist pornography? Mm. It's something I'd like to
what
know.
What is that is what I want to know. Feminist pornography, is this anything? Gloria, quickly.
I've never seen it, so I don't know. I mean, because I'm sort of a word person, you know, writers are crazy about words. So porne means female slaves, and eros, it means, has some connotation of mutual pleasure. And so I am all in favor of feminist erotica. I think that's great. We need much, much more of it.
Ma'am, you've been very pro-abortion. But don't you think that in a country like India, where a woman is already very socially pressurized into aborting her child if the fetus turns out to be female, don't you think that such propaganda might turn out to have adverse effects?
No, that's terrible. That's absolutely awful. No, and I know that India's combating this and trying to make sex-selective abortion illegal and trying to say how important we all know that's awful. It's the cause. It's one of the major causes of a great worldwide tragedy now throughout Asia, not just in India. Which is that there are fewer now, for the first time that I'm aware of, fewer females on this spaceship Earth that we love than there are males.
Amartya Sen, you've written about the missing women.
Yeah, well, I have, but when I wrote first, most of the missing women were because of neglect of living girls as opposed to living boys. That has come down everywhere. On the other hand, missing women haven't gone down because of the fact that that has been replaced. Discrimination against living girls been replaced by sex detection of in the womb, and female selected female feticides. That has been the factor. The thing that was being referred to, I think, if I understood by Vaka at the beginning, in an article I show that if you take as standard, say, European ratios of at birth of female to male, Italy, Spain, Greece, and so on, if you take that as a standard, then every state in the east and south of India, going from Assam, Bengal, all the way to Kerala, have European ratios. And every state in the north and the west has not only below that, but quite a bit below that. There is a there is this span. Now, there's also, therefore, an issue. What is it due to? Is it language? Is it culture? There are connections with language group. There is connection with employment pattern, wage system, and others. There are differences in politics, which are quite clear in many of these cases. So I think we have to study those things. So the question that you're raising, which Gloria rightly responded the way she did, is extremely important. But it should not be seen as going against
the right to choice,
right,
pro choice
abortion, yeah, which is pro-choice. And I think that would be a terrible mistake if we do that. There's a complex question you were raising.
Yeah.
If I had been active and if you had been my student, I would suggest you do a PhD thesis with me on that.
All right, Urmi Dugal.
Is it enough to have women in powerful either political positions or powerful positions in, say, the corporate world or the media? Is it enough to just throw in women in a bag of mix and say, look, we're empowering you?
Mm-hmm. To anyone who wants to take it, maybe I'll start with you, Urvashi. Here's the thing. This is a big divide also, that one school of feminist argument would be, if you had more women in politics, somehow politics would be a more progressive, a more equitable place. The other argument will be that you can't predetermine anybody on the basis of their gender. And I think that's the question that's really being raised here. And Gloria has written earlier that we always talk about raising our daughters like we raise our sons, but we never talk about raising our sons like we raise our daughters.
I think I don't think that it's an either-or situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think both those arguments are true. You do get very clear examples of when women assume positions of power, they become like men, and they start protecting their turf, and there is nothing to say that they will automatically become sympathetic towards other women. But I think you have to also look elsewhere. When we talk of political power, we only look at the top positions. Look at what's happening with the panchayats. Yeah. You have over 1 million women in positions of elected power. What are they doing? Even if half of them are proxies, the other half, what are they doing? They're running schools, they're making sanitation, they're making the fair price shops function, yeah, well, they're looking after kids. They're bringing a different model of using power and governance. And there's a change there. It's changing everybody's lives, including women's. Mm. So I think you have to look at it as something, you have to have a critical mass.
Yeah.
But icons are very important. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Okay. Farhan, let's take a question from Farhan. Where are you, Farhan? Yeah. All right. Farhan, your question.
Yeah, actually, my question is to Miss Gloria. Even in the 21st century, there's a lot of double standard opinion that people have about women. For example, when a man goes along with four women, he is known as a Casanova. But when a woman goes with four men, she becomes a slut. So how do we change that kind of opinion that people have even today?
Do you have that opinion?
No, I don't.
Thank you. Okay.
Once more, I went back to Toledo where I grew up, and I was on television like this with other women, and somebody called from my old neighborhood, which is the wrong part of Toledo, East Toledo, and called me a slut from East Toledo. And I thought, gosh, when I lived there, I would have felt terrible. I would have felt ashamed and terrible. But by then, I thought, that's a pretty good thing to be. So I think part of what movements do is to take bad words and use them for power. And what we really mean by a slut is someone with no discrimination. And I can tell you any number of male sluts.
All right. Question here in the middle, center row in the red.
We all are fighting for women's rights and feminism. And there is another section among us that is also fighting for reservation. How does this sort of bring about, sense of equality?
Are you for women's reservation?
No.
You're not?
No, not.
You don't want greater representation in parliament?
I think we can do that without having reservation. We have very strong women all over. Mm. We don't
can
need
I
to have
to
reservations to bring
yeah,
in.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question. The reservation issue is connected with the fact when there is an actual prejudice. And there is a lot of economic literature on that. Prejudice against women, prejudice against blacks, prejudice against one group or another. And quite often when you're having a job interview, you don't know the qualifications of the person. Mm. All you could see that it's a woman, it's a man, or it's a black person or a colored person. That produces the kind of inherent bias and the affirmative action which was introduced, and in which Ambedkar played a big part in this country. We were the first country to bring in the affirmative action. It was to counter the social prejudice. That was the idea. Mm. It was never thought to be an ideal system forever, mm-hmm, as long as the bad system exists to do that. So that's the way to do it. Secondly, I agree with it, that it also depends quite a bit on how much you pay attention to the equity of between men and women, looking at everything together. And when you are in charge of something, you could do it. And that is not only a matter that applies to India. I mean, when I was head of an English college, Trinity College, Cambridge, when I joined, there were 3 women fellows out of 174. Mm-hmm. Now, we didn't have affirmative action, but there were additional considerations when you're looking at publication. If young women are somewhat deficient because they've been doing other things in the formative years, like in 20s and 30s, then pay attention to that. Now, I don't think it's a great achievement, but by the time I finished after 6 years, there were 29 women as opposed to 3. And none of this was done by affirmative action. Yeah. On the other hand, by bringing in a measure of equity in the thing. So I'm basically sympathetic to the point, but don't be unsympathetic to the idea of reservation at a time when there are lots of people who are not going to get that consideration. There is a basic need for addressing the issue of gender equity, which we haven't yet got to, and to shoot anything like reservation without knowing what its consequences would be. Would be serious. So I agree with you at an intellectual level, but at a practical level, I think you may still be going in
all
the
right,
wrong
I'm
direction.
All right, I'm really short of time. So, Nandita, I'm going to allow you 30 seconds, and I probably have time for just 2 more questions. Nandita.
There are historic wrongs that have happened. And like he said, Baba Ambedkar never thought that this was going to last forever. But there are a lot of marginalized communities, whether it's the Dalits, whether it's women who've been left out of processes.
Yeah.
So till such times that things actually become, you know, equal and there's a level playing field, there will be reservations. Or like, for instance, in Bombay locals, there are women's compartment. If women weren't groped and harassed and all of that, maybe there wouldn't be a need for a women compartment. But ask the women who travel, and you know, they sort of think as a blessing if they manage to get into a women's compartment because they feel safer. So I think reservation or affirmative action is extremely needed till things are so unequal.
All right, gentlemen here in the front row in the red jacket.
You said that there are things to be done in right earnest. So what are the things that need to be done?
Well, there are many things. I do have an article on this called Indian Women, The Mixed Truth. That's in New York Review, October 10. I hope some Indian paper plagiarizes it and publishes it somewhere. I don't know why they're so inactive. But there are many things. Now, actually, I think probably the biggest one of extraordinary importance that's neglected is the sex trafficking issue. And here the class plays a very big part. You haven't met many people from whom girls have been sex trafficked. You probably have gone into someone whose some sister or somebody might have been sexually harassed. So sexual harassment, which was a good thing that the Verma committee did, to put it in its at par with rape in some sense, was a good thing. But it still had a big class bias. So the main thing to do are those things that affect women badly, especially when they come from the bottom classes, caste, and so on. So if you happen to be a woman of a low income, lower class, low caste, your chances are extraordinarily little. So I would say that given the amount of things we can do, and I hope all of these will be done eventually, the priority has to be on those things which get the least attention in the media now.
The gentleman here in the front row, yes.
My question is basically that I find myself agreeing with certain radical feminist ideologies like overhyping of motherhood, marriage, and such institutions which are forced upon women, especially in India, where marriage is seen as a very important milestone in a woman's life. So how relevant are these radical feminist ideologies in a country where women are forced, seen to get married by 28.
Can I put that to you? And you know why I'm asking you this. Because you spent most of your life saying that marriage actually reduced a woman to a half person. And in your 60s, you got married, and it was a personal choice that was so scrutinized, so over-scrutinized. Did you end up changing your mind about what marriage does to women?
No, and I never said marriage made everybody into a half person. I just said the laws were lousy. We had to change the laws so that you didn't lose all your civil rights and so on. And I got married at 66, and the only reason we loved each other, we wanted to be together. The only reason we got married was he needed a green card, and and the laws had changed. We had worked very hard to change them over 30 years, And this turned out to be a blessing for a sad but crucial reason, which he was on my health insurance, you know. So, but the truth is, I couldn't have done it if I had read the law, in the old days when the laws took your rights away.
All right, last question. I think I'm really out of time. The girl in the gray jacket here. Yeah.
I just wanted to actually talk quickly about the perception of gender that we have here. So we have policies that maybe are still changing. Adoption laws just changed in the 21st century to finally allow a married woman the same rights as her husband in terms of adoption of her own child. Mm-hmm. Marital rape is still not rape. Maybe these things will happen. However, the policy in most women's households, and here we are talking about India, really, is the policy that her husband decides is right for her to live by. Yeah. So if she's not allowed to go outside her house, she's not allowed to go outside her house. She's not allowed to keep her ghungat up. She's not allowed to keep it up. She has to get chai for everybody. She has to stay home to take care of her children. How do we tackle the percolation of this knowledge and this empowerment that I feel like I have more than my grandmother did because of people like you?
What usually happens, I can't speak, you know, each woman needs to decide, but what usually happens is that women get together in small groups and begin to talk to each other. And it is revolutionary, you know, because you discover you're not crazy, you're not alone, you have support from other women. Every revolution I know of, the Chinese Revolution, the Civil Rights Movement, the feminist, has always started with small groups of women talking to each other, supporting each other, gaining strength, and in this case, being able to stand up to injustice at home as well.
Can I give the last word to the young man there at the top? Yes.
I just want to have one question to the entire panel, that the recent food security bill had a clause saying that the eldest woman of the household will be the head of the family rather than the man of the household. Do you think this is a success of a feminism, or do you think this is just a cosmetic change?
Professor Sen?
It was generally thought that if the food comes to the family, and I think the question that was being raised earlier, person in the front row, that it may be distributed as the person, the male commander of the family, wants. And so the food security bill is an attempt to work against that. Okay. Just as there was also the question, on which there's a lot of evidence, when you provide feeding rather than dry ration, that happens to be better distributed than people taking dry ration and doing it. So the short answer to the question, yes, that is a positive aspect of a bill which has some serious defects also.
The young girl in the black in the front row.
We've been talking about prostitution, and it's a very normative question which of the three ways we should go. But say, even if you criminalize prostitution or you penalize the male, but in a more practical sense, in a country like India, we're working with a lot of prejudice against prostitutes. The juries, judges, policemen, nobody would believe prostitutes when they say, yeah, we have been exploited.
Ruchi, do you want to quickly take that? And then I have to close.
Yes, I think the burden of proof, that's why it needs to shift to the perpetrator rather than from the victim. Because right now the law is such that the prostitute has to prove whether she chose this, didn't choose it, what happened to her when she was 12. And that's why precisely we say don't get into this argument of choice. Look at her lack of choices.
Can I end by just asking you, and all of us as women and men have gone through this, you have some assumptions and then you live a little more and your assumptions get challenged and they keep getting readapted. Did you find that you started off with something in the debate around gender, and then when you lived a little more, you found that the assumption didn't hold?
There is not a certain rule of feminist principles.
No, in your self-image, you say, okay, I'll be like this.
But there's not. It's very important to know. We're just all human beings. Hello? You know? We don't think about agency. Most people don't know what the word means. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I'm so grateful to you who talk about action. You know, that's the point. Not to worry about what you can't do, but do what you can.
Yeah.
That is absolutely crucial. Yeah. And the art of behaving effectively as an organizer and a revolutionary and happily as a human being is behaving as if everything you do matters. And remember that the end is the means. The end doesn't justify the means. It is the means. So if we want to have, you know, love and learning and humor and you know, whatever. At the end, we want to have love and learning and music and humor on the way.
Yeah.
And just behave as if everything you do matters, because I promise you, you'll be amazed at how much that you do really matters.
All right, we leave it there. I think every story counts. Everything you do counts.
Right.
Let not the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yeah.
Nandita Das, Urvashi Batalia, Ruchira Gupta, Vartha Sen, and Gloria Steinem. And thank you. We hope you have a good stay in India, and you had a profound impact along with so many other people. I always say that the generations that came before ours made it possible for us to even be having these conversations today. So I think that's really important. Thank you very much, everyone.